This is an oral history interview with Earl Barkley, conducted by Dirk Hermance. The date is May 20th, 1993. Mr. Barkley lives at this time at 47544 State Route 14, New Waterford, Ohio. The zip code is 44445. This interview is being conducted in an office in the history department. The date is May 20th, 1993. And the time is just about 10:30. Okay, Mr. Barkley, on Pearl Harbor Day, why don't you tell me where you were and what's your first recollection of that day?
I was sleeping on a cot on the top side of the USS Whitney, right near the an ammunition box for the 3-inch 50 anti-aircraft guns. And my first recollection was being half asleep and half awake and hearing guns firing.
What time was that?
No, that would have been right after the attack started, 8 o'clock
early,
yeah.
So,
and I wondered what we were doing out to sea firing, because the destroyers had been belting machine gun ammunition for anti-aircraft practice, and this old ship had to go every so often, went out for practice, but not very often, but it did go out for practice. And that thought went through my mind, what are we doing out to sea on Sunday? And about that time, a fire controlman rushed out of the fire control shack. He grabbed me right by the arm, stood me on my feet, and said, the damn Japs are bombing us.
Really?
And so I just took my foot, kicked the cot aside, because I could still hear the explosions and the machine gun fire vividly, because the machine guns alongside and the destroyers alongside were firing. And I ran over and looked astern, which directly astern was Ford Island, and at Battleship Row, and I could there were great columns of smoke, but the sun was shining bright enough I could see the Jap planes with the red discs on the wings, the silver plane light with the red disc on the wings, as they banked away, you know, after they had dropped the torpedoes.
Were they low?
Yes, they were low. Yeah.
Very low?
Yeah, very low at that time.
What vintage was your destroyer? Did you have one of the older model destroyers?
This was a destroyer tender. It was. Oh, it was put in commission, I think, back around 1920 or 24, somewhere in there.
Was it a four-stacker?
No, this here was an old tender. This was a ship that held approximately 900 men. What we did was service the destroyers, and that morning we had five destroyers alongside us. We had the Cunningham, the Reed, the Tucker, the Case, and the Selfridge was tied up alongside of us. And our job was to, when they had fired their torpedoes, we brought them on board and they cleaned them, restored them for another firing. We supplied them with ammunition. We even supplied them with stores for food, you know, and that sort of thing. That was our job, to take care of these destroyers.
Okay, what was your specific task?
I was a gunner's mate striker, what is called a striker, or an apprentice gunner's mate. I had gone through Great Lakes boot camp. I had trained at Great Lakes for aviation ordnance, which included torpedoes, machine guns, and gunnery, aircraft machine guns and gunnery. And we had 12 weeks training, so I was sent to the destroyer fleet in the Pacific. And then I'd been sent to mine school just before Pearl Harbor from 1st of August till 24th of October. I'd been in mine school on a submarine base out there, setting the Mark 10 mine. They wanted somebody on every ship that would be able to disarm a mine if it was found floating. And I'd been sent to this mine school, then sent back to the USS Whitney for further transfer to a destroyer in the fleet.
Now, December 7th is your birthday.
Yeah.
How old were you that day?
18.
Exactly 18.
Exactly 18. I joined for a minority cruise when I was 17 years old. I was 17 years old on December 7, 1940, and I went into sworn in the Navy December 27, 1940.
So you were able to get in at 17?
Yes. At that time they had a deal where you could get in on a minority cruise. It was, at that time they were signing up like 6-year cruises, but you could, by being 17, I could sign up till I was 21.
Oh, I understand.
And
okay.
Be released.
So you'd only have 4 years,
yep,
instead of 6.
4 years instead of 6, yeah.
Now, tell me this then. As a striker, now you say your job entailed rearming, okay, other vessels, other destroyers. You learned how to defuse mines. What about torpedoes?
I didn't learn anything about torpedoes. I did not get in a torpedo. That was what I wanted to be, was a torpedoman, really. But I didn't get into that. But our job, really, on the ship, our job was to take care of our own guns, keep them clean. We had machine guns, 50 caliber machine guns. We had 3-inch 50 anti-aircraft guns, and we had 5-inch 51 main battery guns, old bag-type guns that used powder bags.
Right, right.
And shell casings. But our job was to take care of those. We had a gunner's gang that I was just making a rough guess. I would say that we had about 15, 18 men, something like that, counting the chiefs on that ship, 15 or 18 men that took care of the guns on the USS Whitney.
Okay, so most of your job on the Whitney, anyway, did it entail a lot of waiting? Or
yeah.
Were you pretty busy?
Well, they kept you busy, you know, because we had that, we helped a lot of work details, like ammunition parties, you know, where you would pass ammunition to other ships.
Right.
And get them, they'd come in and tie up just for a day or two, and then they'd be re-ammoed and re-stored with food and gone again, refueled and in some cases and gone again.
How long did that take?
What do you mean?
How long would it take you to tend a ship like a destroyer?
Well, depending on what they needed, really, depending on what they needed. Some of them we had a regular boiler shop, we had a machine shop, we had the torpedo shop, as I say, and what they would do is go out and fire their torpedoes in a dummy run.
Right.
They had to retrieve these things because they cost a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
They had to retrieve them. They'd bring them back, and they would bring them in, and we would take them aboard our ship into the torpedo shop. We had a huge, large torpedo shop. They had to be completely disassembled and reassembled again and made ready to go, charged with alcohol and with water, and ready to go again. They were steam-driven torpedoes is what they were.
That's right. Those are the early torpedoes that were steam-driven.
Yeah, steam-driven torpedoes.
Before they came up with the electrics.
Yeah.
Okay. Give me an idea. Average turnover time. Tend a ship. Nothing major has to be done. How long did it take?
Oh, they could do one in a day. Like, you know, to...
Rearm and...
Yeah, rearm. Give ammunition. Give food if they needed it. And if there's nothing... major to be done, they could do it, and they could tie up like in the morning and be gone in the evening.
Okay. What was your routine during your average day? On or off, take your pick, whether you had somebody to tend or not.
We mostly took the guns apart, cleaned them, put them back together, policed around all around the gun areas, you know what I mean, the gun
mm-hmm.
areas. And just any painting, chipping, like on gun shields. You always have chipping and painting to do on a ship, even if it's not out at sea. But you always have that kind of thing to do. And that's the most thing we did.
Okay.
But usually you would get an ammunition working party maybe at least every other day, you know.
Pearl Harbor morning. They shook you out of bed. You kicked the cot aside. You're on the deck. What happened?
Well, being a gunner's mate, I knew we needed ammunition immediately. And about that time, the ship had sounded general quarters, which was a gong, gong,
right.
gong.
Yep.
Yeah, they had sounded general quarters, and the gun crew that manned these 3-inch 50 anti-aircraft guns, they rushed up and they tore the covers. We had canvas covers on them. They took the covers off. And I located the first class in charge of magazines, a McGee, and we went, he tried to get the keys for the magazines off the captain. But there was so much going on, so much excitement, so much confusion that he couldn't even speak to the captain hardly. So we just went down to the handling rooms. We had a handling room, and there'd be a magazine on all four sides of it.
Right.
They were locked with locks.
How far down was that?
That was just like second or third deck.
Okay.
You'd have like, you'd have shells one place, powder in another, you know.
Right.
And we had, I forget how many of those magazines we really had on there now anymore. It was about, we had about three or four magazines up forward. And we took a fire axe and chopped the locks off the doors. We didn't have time, and we had to get in there to get ammunition, we felt. And this 3-inch .50 ammunition came in a box, 4 shells to a box.
Mm-hmm.
And they weighed about 120 pounds. Well, I weighed about 140 pounds.
As I recall, a box for that ammunition is about as long as this desk here.
Yeah, so it's something like this.
And about that wide?
Yeah. Square.
Yeah. Right.
So they put 4 shells in there, and they have a wooden thing to keep in place, you know what I mean? Round it out so the shells will lay in there just nicely.
Yeah, this desk is about 5 feet mm-hmm. long. Is that about right?
Well, it wouldn't be quite that long. The fixed ammunition, they'd be about like this, probably.
So that's about
3.5 foot.
3.5, 4 foot.
Yeah.
Okay, so wooden boxes square.
Yeah.
The four rounds in a box.
And a lanyard on each end that you could pick it up by.
Right, right. Normally, four rounds in a box.
Yeah. Normally two guys handle it, but that day I handled it.
All by yourself.
And carried it up through 2 decks. Well, 3 decks actually, because I was clear up on the top side. That's where our guns were. We did have a 3-inch .50 forward.
How'd you carry one of those up the gangway?
Put it on your shoulder.
Just heaved it over.
Carried it. You know, when
how many decks? 3?
When you're propelled by necessity and fear,
you do a lot
of work, you know. You're able to do things you're not able to do other times, really.
3 decks.
Yeah, at least 3 decks I had. They were handed up 1 deck, so I only had to carry them about 3 decks.
That's not bad.
No, I got away.
If you're in a hurry.
But we did. It was all fairly orderly. I mean, mm-hmm. considering the attack, under attack, the planes flying, this, that, the guns firing on them, the destroyers alongside were putting up a terrific anti-aircraft barrage, you know, because we had 5 of them, and they had 50-caliber machine guns, and one of them was a flotilla leader, and it had a 1.175 pom-pom, which was a 4-barrel
right.
job.
Yep.
They didn't prove very good, because they managed to keep 1 barrel firing at a time. That's about it. I mean, one would quit, and then they'd get it going, and another would quit.
They jammed?
But they did, yeah, they jammed. They jammed easily. It was a gun that was...
Was it lack of training or the failure of
no,
the equipment?
No, it was failure of equipment. The way the shells were made, the size of shell and what they were trying to do with it. Now, 40 millimeter, on the other hand, in a clip of 4 or 8
yeah.
worked just fine. You set them
slap
on top.
Slap them in and they go.
Right, went right down through, you know. But these guns weren't made that easy. They were made so they could jam. They were able to, and most of them I've heard throughout the fleet that was the big problem with them, was jamming.
So the pom-poms jammed.
Yeah, they just didn't. The 50-caliber machine guns were more effective than the pom-poms were, because they didn't.
Because the 50s wouldn't jam.
No, they didn't jam. They didn't. If they did, you know, if you had one shell, it wouldn't fire or jam. You just grab the thing, give it a pull, and you're firing again.
Okay.
But
now you've been down in the magazine. You got a box of shells. You're going up deck, mm-hmm. up to top. Then what happens? Where'd you go?
Get another.
Is that all?
Because you have to get them to the gun crew. So
took them those 3-inch.
Yeah.
The gun and then back downstairs.
Yeah, we had 3 or 4 guys doing this. You know.
Did you have to go in the turret, or did you just was there somebody with the door open?
It was open.
Open. See, open gun pit.
Open. Yeah, they were open. They were just out in the open.
And all you did was shuttle.
Yeah. And we didn't have a director for fire. These guys had to point, and they had to work the hand wheels and point and train their own gun around and up and down elevation.
Was there a lot of confusion on the part of the officers?
No, I don't think so. I think, as I remembered it, there wasn't. You know, everyone, they did pretty good. You know, after the initial shock was over, man, they settled right in. And
now the Japanese
did pretty good.
The Japanese came in more than one wave.
Yeah.
Now, when did the first wave end? Do you recall?
No, I don't. Really, I don't.
There was a lull.
I mean, at the time, if I remember correctly, about the time that lull would have been, I did go down through the mess hall and grabbed a cup of coffee or juice or something, you know.
Really?
But that was it. Just
because
my mouth was so dry, you know, you had to have something. And I really did. I grabbed something and said a few words to a couple of people. But other than that,
And one of the other Pearl Harbor survivors, it was warm that morning.
Yeah.
Sun was up.
It's always warm.
Clear as the dickens, yeah. One of the other Pearl Harbor survivors I've talked to said he was basically had nothing much on but a t-shirt and underwear.
Probably.
You in the same boat?
No, I grabbed my dungarees. I had dungarees.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a t-shirt. Dungarees and t-shirt. I had, because I had that right there at the cot, you know.
Right.
And I don't know whatever happened to the cot even when I kicked it aside. I don't know what happened to it. I don't remember whether I, you know, found it after the attack was over, whether I found it to sleep on or what I did anymore, whether I got another one or something.
How close were you to the Langley?
I don't know. I really don't know where she was birthed at.
Because she was
exactly.
In...
Exactly. I mean, I have a map at home where all of them were, but I don't really know.
Wasn't she in a dry dock down?
It's possible.
Down the ways?
It's possible. It's possible the Langley.
Because the Langley blew up entirely.
Yeah. She may have been hit and dry. I think it seems to me she might have, because I don't remember any of them that were out in, you know, in the harbor blowing up like that.
Okay.
The battleships.
How close were you to the battleships?
Oh, in miles, I can't. I'd say about a mile or less, 3/4 of a mile, a mile, something like that, across the harbor. You know, on the water, it fools you. It could have been a mile and a half more near than 3/4, you know. But when you come in the harbor, you immediately, coming in from the west, you immediately see a Ford Island in the middle, you know.
Right.
And then you go around Ford Island, one side or the other. The battleships were tied up alongside Ford Island. That's where Battleship Row was, right, alongside Ford Island.
So you were across the way
from
them?
We were straight east of them, and directly east of us was a tank farm, an oil tank farm that was on the beach there. But we were closer to the beach than we were to the battleships, and yet there was quite a distance of water in between there. We were on a buoy. They had buoys around there to tie to, so. We were tied to the buoys, then the destroyers moored to us. That's where it went.
How many ships were in harbor? Got any idea?
I shouldn't know, but you know what I mean. It's something that's been talked about, and that's not been mentioned much how many, but there was quite a few of them. I know the Dixie had 5 destroyers alongside her. There was other destroyers. There were cruisers in there. There was quite a few compared to other times, you know what I mean?
Right.
It was. It seemed there was more ships in harbor than normal at that time.
Were you anticipating being inspected, having an inspection by chance?
No, not.
There was no word of that for you.
No.
Now you were near the tank farms.
Not too far. The tank.
Easily visible from where.
Oh yeah, yeah. You can see them. They look, you know, huge tank, oil tank storage places.
Do you recall any Japanese planes going near the tank farms?
Not over by our way, except the ones that may have flown over the top, you know, over top of us.
They didn't even target them.
No, I don't believe so. Not those anyhow.
Now they fired at you and they bombed you guys.
They dropped a bomb.
Dropped bombs.
75 foot from our fantail or something, and they strafed.
But that's
like
it. They didn't.
Like I said, the destroyers were putting up a heavy enough anti-aircraft fire that when they dropped their torpedo and veered toward us, they tended to veer away because the destroyers were really putting up a hail of bullets, you know, 50-caliber bullets and 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft fire. And they did have, better guidance, you know, on their anti-aircraft fire than we did. The only thing, it was so close range that a 5-inch shell wouldn't explode.
Uh-huh.
In such a close range. You know, when you fire 5 inches is a surface or anti-aircraft gun, it has a range of close to 8 mile. And usually you have it set for, so it'll burst at about 40,000 feet. You know, shell burst, it's timed with a timing device in the nose.
Uh-huh.
And depending on the range of your planes, that's where the director starts setting your fuses at. You have fuse setters right on your guns. You stick them in there, and they're put in there, and then they're given to the shellman, gets them, and he puts them in the gun for anti-aircraft attack.
So most of your time that morning for the first and second attack then was mostly hustle and shell?
Getting ammunition, making sure there was ammunition there. I did not man a gun or anything like that.
I didn't fire a shot, no,
because I didn't have a gun. You know, I didn't have a gun stationed. I didn't man the gun. I would have manned the gun if we'd have been at sea, on like if there had been a ship attack, a surface attack.
Yeah.
Because we had 5-inch 51s, and I would have manned one of those. I'd been on one of those.
Let me ask you this: What did you even get a chance to see what was going on elsewhere, or were you just too busy?
Mostly too busy. I saw one plane that was hit, the stern of us. I think it was the one that dropped the bomb.
A Japanese plane.
Yeah, they hit him and blew a wing off. One of the destroyers hit him and blew a wing off. And he veered over and crashed in the harbor.
Close by?
Yeah.
How close?
Not too far away. Oh, probably a mile away. I imagine a mile away in the harbor. Just half a mile to a mile, three quarters of a mile.
Were you anywhere near the submarine pens?
No, not too close. They were over at the sub base where I had gone to mine school, but we weren't close to them. Not real
close.
Of course, that harbor's not, you know, not all that huge. You're pretty well bunched in there, even so.
Second wave of Japanese planes. What happened?
It seemed there's a more concentrated and steady fire. And they came in dive bombers, most of them. And the torpedo planes had done their thing. The dive bombers came in. They didn't show so plainly. You know, they had a steady anti-aircraft fire was coming up then. By then, the Army even and the Marines on the beach had gotten into the act, and they were firing on them, you know, and they were on the planes. And that kept them up a little higher. Now they didn't come down amongst us like that first attack, the torpedo planes and fighters.
Were they more interested in the battleships?
Yeah.
Seemed to be.
There still was the main thrust of the attack was on Port Island, the battleships, Hickam Field, Chapter, those places like that, Fort Chapter, Hickam Field, now, which I couldn't see any of those. But that's where they were, I think, the second wave mostly hit us.
The second wave went more towards the airfield.
Yeah, knocking out.
Because they were dive bombing rather than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Knocking out airfields and things like that.
How long did that go on?
Seemed like forever. A couple hours, I guess. I mean, maybe it wasn't even that long. It only been an hour and a half.
It's hard to tell what
the
time was.
It seemed like all day because even though when it was over, we were still busy, you know. I mean, we were. Later in the afternoon, I did see lifeboats with bodies in them. I couldn't identify anything, but the bodies were in and covered, you know, were some of the boats from various ships, not from the ones that were sunk, were helping in the rescuing or picking up the bodies and that sort of thing.
When it was all over, what'd you do?
Thank God. No, we were really keyed up then. I don't even remember eating that day. I don't remember. I know I did eat, you know, but I don't even remember eating. I don't remember if we had a regular organized meal, you know, like lunch. I don't think we did. And I don't know what we ate or anything else. I don't even remember eating that evening, because that evening was still a tense time. While the one attack was going on, some planes from bombers, flying forts, were coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the guys got excited and started shooting at them. I don't know what ships or anything, but they were coming in over the tank farm.
That's a little after 9 in the morning, if I'm not mistaken.
Around that time, yes.
Yeah.
And they were coming in over the. That was probably when the second wave got there, I imagine, more or less. But they were shooting at everything. Them, you know, by that
they
time.
Shot they shot at everything
they
that
were shooting
moved.
Everything that moved, yeah. Because they didn't. Well, probably this was a case of. I'd gone to school, and after that, I went to school a lot more, plane identification. And so they flash something on the screen just for a split second, like a Japanese bow, and you're supposed to be able to identify. Especially for us, because later on I was a mount captain on a destroyer, and you had to know them kind of things, you know. You had to be able to identify planes and all that sort of thing better. This time there was just like I say, that it seemed to me, I mean, in my mind, as well as I can remember, the second attack. The gunners on all ships and that, there was more like, we're veterans now, we're settled down, we know we're not just shooting, you know,
we're
shooting at you, you know.
In other words, no more battle nerves. You were set.
You settled in.
You know, okay, well, we know what to do now.
That's right. That's right. And first, when I first went to those magazines, you don't have a chance to think, you know, realize much. Although I did realize that one bomb in one of those powder magazines, and it was all over, you know, as far as I was concerned. I realized that.
Did you get underway?
No.
Stayed docked?
Yeah, we stayed there docked. Tied to the buoy. Yeah. With the destroyer, they didn't even get underway. They stayed right with us. Stayed tied to us.
What was the first thing you heard from your officers? What did they say?
Nothing. No, you know what I mean, any more than just to relate that it was a devastating attack and we'd been, you know, hit hard and they exhorted the men, you know, to acquit themselves well and to not be discouraged and that we were going to bounce back from this thing.
Mm-hmm. How much information did they give you? What did they tell you?
Not a whole lot. I mean, other than, see, we pretty well knew, you know, how many battleships were down and all this and that. We pretty well knew. We knew one was a grounder with the mouth of the harbor, and we knew that the Arizona was gone, Utah had turned over, and we knew that the West Virginia, the Colorado, the California, and the Tennessee, and then was out of it, you know, Maryland.
How much concern was there about the carriers?
Not much, because they weren't there.
So you didn't even talk about the carriers because you knew they weren't in port.
It was kind of funny though. The night before, the Enterprise went out. The night before, she stood out going to wake.
Yeah.
And when she went out, she went right past the stern of our ship, and I happened to be on deck at that time. And it seemed funny to me because usually you don't see a big ship like that going out at night, but she went out on the night before, probably around. Or just after dark, a little bit. She had her lights on her, you know, you could see the, she's all lit up and everything, you know, you could see the...
No cautionary...
No precaution like that.
In other words, you weren't under any warnings, were you?
And it did seem, no, huh? It did seem funny that she had, you know, was going out at night because most ships didn't go out at night. Not the big ones, they had no battle wagons or aircraft carriers go out at night usually.
But she went out fully lit.
She went out with her. Well, you could see the decks, you know, the portholes, and even the doors to the deck.
No blackout precautions of any kind.
No, there was no blackout. She was going to wake, I understand, take planes to wake or something, wake out or something.
Were you close enough to holler?
No. Uh-huh.
So you couldn't talk to him?
We wouldn't talk to him, really. No. Uh-huh. But. That was, she was at 12 hours out about, I understand. And what happened, I was told that when she moved out from Fort Island, they put the Utah in her place, the old target ship Utah. That's why it was hit first. I assume that's why it was hit first, because they were after the carrier first, you know.
They put the Utah where the Enterprise had been berthed.
Yeah, they moved her up from where she had been berthed. They moved the Utah.
The Utah was a World War I vessel.
Yeah, and they used it for a target ship.
Right, and they had...
target, that sort of thing.
Yeah, everything was basically inert on that ship. Well,
it was a target ship for battleships.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
They used it. And it had a big target, you know, towed a big target, had a big target on it, even, so I suppose, in some cases.
So they put it where the Enterprise had been. That's very interesting.
Now that's what I understood. They moved it up where the Enterprise had been. For not a precautionary measure or anything like that, or I don't, not that I know of, to even fool anybody. It was just a case that she wasn't in her regular spot because the Enterprise was there, and then when the Enterprise went out, she moved back to that spot.
Okay, so the Enterprise had been parked where the Utah normally had been docked.
Normally had been docked. Just put her back where she had been before.
Huh.
As far as I know, that's what I've been told.
It's 5 o'clock, Pearl Harbor Day. What are you doing?
I think about that time is when we try to get something to eat. And we're just sitting around more. We were manned. The guns were all manned. Still manned. They kept the guns manned all day and all night. Mostly at that time, we were trying to get something to eat and get lined up for the evening, you know, what watches we're going to stand and who's going to be on watch and all this sort of thing. It was starting to fall into a, we might say a preparedness routine in case of another attack, although I don't believe there were many people who thought that they pretty well understood that this was a hit and run thing. Most of them were saying, well, boy, we were just fortunate they didn't send some transports with them, you know, and make a landing, which would have made a lot harder thing, way to dislodge them. They could have done more damage than they did, although probably with all the extra ships and that, they wouldn't have had the secrecy, you know, that was why they didn't, I imagine.
Where was the best view from your ship? Bow or stern?
Oh, it would have been a stern.
What'd you see looking off the stern?
Well, you can see the smoke and all that. See, where I was at, I was up on top side, though. If I'd been directly on the stern, I could have seen everything. But I was a deck higher. I was up higher, but actually two decks almost higher. Like you'd be in this building, be like two floors higher.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked back, I had to look around the side of there was a library in the middle. There was the gunner's mate shack, the fire control room, and another storeroom.
So you're on the second level.
Across this, and I had to look around that to see anything.
Okay, because you were still, in other words, you were still staying pretty close to your gun.
Yeah. Well, we did get on, like, by five in the afternoon, we had looked around, you know what I mean? We could see the battleship was still smoking, you know, still fire and everything. And everything was pretty much in disarray, you know. It was pretty well cluttered up, you might say. The water was covered with oil, debris floating around. Even some, not at that time probably, but just not long before then, still been some fire in the water, you know, from oil burning in the water.
Any wounded on your ship?
No, we did not have one wounded. We were very fortunate. They did scrape some, but we didn't have any wounded.
Nobody killed?
Nobody got killed. Nope, we didn't lose a man. We were very lucky. And I don't think the destroyers alongside us lost anything.
I'm going to jog your memory. How do you defuse a World War II mine? Do you remember?
Bill, we studied the Mark 10 mine. And what you have to do is be able to just break the circuit. You can take a horn loose, you know, or something. You break the circuit, that's all you have to do.
Did you have a...
And it's disarmed.
Is there one horn in particular you got to go for, or any?
Any of them would have... See, all of them were armed, or the horns
right.
were especially, and all of them were armed. If you could break the circuit by taking one loose, disconnecting one, you know, disconnect the way you break the circuit there, and then the thing is disarmed.
Was it delicate?
Like opening a switch.
Was it delicate?
Yeah, it would have been delicate, even then, because... you know, we had learned that the Germans, you know, had planted booby traps under that horns so that you couldn't disarm. So, and they had cases where they even they were very careful to try to spot booby traps under them, you know, anything at all that would indicate that they had been, that the horn had been taken out and put back in, you know, or anything like that recently.
When you disarm a mine, did you have to get in the water with it?
Yeah, you would have
to hang on to it.
You'd have to go by boat over there, you know, or something.
Or you hang out of the boat.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, or of course we didn't have any diving, you know, any diving experience or anything as divers, anything like that. So it was a case of disarming them by going amongst them with a boat, a small boat, just a motor launch.
How'd you feel about doing that?
I didn't think I'd like to have to do it. I was hoping I wouldn't have to, to be honest with you. I was hoping I wouldn't have to.
But you wanted to learn how?
Well, yeah, I would, more or less, I didn't even give a lot of time. I was picked. interested because I'd already gone to school.
Who picked you?
I suppose my record, the captain of everything. When I was, when I went out there, I went on a troop transport out to Hawaii. I arrived there about in July. I immediately went aboard the USS Dixie. Well, somehow, whether they eeny, meeny, miny, moe, or what, half of us, some of us were sent to the Dixie, some to the USS Dobbins, some to the USS Antare. All three were destroyer tenders, see. And I happened to go to the Altair. They sent me aboard the Altair, and for 2 days I thought I was going to be a torpedoman. That's what I wanted to be, see. And that had been my preference, so that was in my record, and probably that was... That was why I was sent to the Altair. But they had apparently received a call for somebody, school-minded and everything, to be sent to mine school. So, and here I am, a new man. I'm not working into their system or anything, so they just shuttled me on to mine school.
Did you have a sea daddy?
No. No, we kiddingly talk, you know, but no, I didn't really. I didn't have somebody that really, you know, took me under the wing and just looked out for me. I had friends among a lot of people, and this old gunner's mate, I still think of him a lot of times. Fibber McGee, we called him.
Really?
And he wasn't that old, although he had been old enough that he'd seen duty in Asia, you know.
Is this the same McGee you were talking about earlier?
Yeah.
What was his first name?
Can't even remember. I think it was Clarence, but I'm not sure. We always called him Fibber.
Where'd he come from, you know?
I don't even remember where he came from. We had a couple fellow McGee, and we had a guy named Doherty. And I can't remember his first name. He had gotten married over in Honolulu. His wife had come out there, his fiance had come out there, and he'd gotten married just, oh, two or three weeks before Pearl Harbor.
Really?
He'd gotten married. But some of those, I try to remember all, I can't even remember the names, all of them, you know, the top guys we had hardly anymore.
Can you remember your captain?
I don't even remember the captain's name. I knew it well, but I don't remember it now. I don't really remember it now.
Any senior officers?
He was a commander. The captain was a commander.
He was a commander?
Yeah. In rank, he was a commander.
Any other senior officers? Recall any of them?
Oh, mercy. Hey. Larson. He was the old chief warrant gunner.
Chief gunner?
He was a warrant gunner.
Warrant gunner, okay.
Yeah, he was a full warrant, not... See, Well, he'd gone through as a warrant gunner and then wound up with a lieutenant commander stripes, I think he had finally. But he was a nice sort of, most of these, to me, they were ancient. See, they were probably men about 40 years old, 45 maybe, you know. I suppose the skipper might have been 50. I don't know if he's that old. To me, these guys were ancient. I was 18.
Yeah.
We had some nice officers. We had real nice officers, you know, on the ship. Of course, on a ship like that, the only ones you really get to know very well are your gunner officer, your gunnery officer, and your warrant gunner, and your the skipper, and the exec. I don't remember the executive officer's name on that ship anymore, but because, like I say, I'd only been on there from October 24th to December 7th. And we had about 900 men, and even a man here that comes to a Pearl Harbor survivors meeting, I don't remember seeing him on there. You know,
on the same boat?
Yeah, I didn't know him because we had 900 men.
900 men.
There's about 900 men on there.
That's a lot.
Especially after the attacks. See, we had men for further assignment to other ships.
Who was that?
Pardon?
Who was the other fellow that was on the same ship?
Clifton. Tom Clifton. He belongs to Pearl Harbor Survivors Association here, Chapter 5 in Mahoning Valley.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Tom Clifton. And then there's more. I just got the gram, and my wife was asking me a couple of names. One of them sounded familiar, but I couldn't picture him, you know. I very few that I remember. I remember a Glenn Heathman. He was a first-class gunner's mate. When I went on there, he was a second-class, but he was a first-class gunner's mate coming from Pontiac, Michigan. I remember him, see his face as plain as could be, you know. He was a blonde-headed, nice young person, nice fellow.
Coral Harbor plus 3 days. What's going on?
For some reason, I went on a working party, and I don't know to this day. I've tried to figure out what I went for. We were over on the board, the USS West Virginia. She was, I think, tied up beside the Maryland, you know, during the attack. And they were both settled in the water, that there was water over the deck. You could walk on the top deck, but there was this much water there, so you had to wave. I don't know why we went. I don't know what we did.
Was it rescue operations?
Something like that, or whether it was just to see if there was something that we could do, you know, maybe. Because I don't remember that we did anything, but I remember going over there and getting aboard her, going out of the boat and being aboard her, but I don't remember. I remember the smell, you know, the smell of fire, oil, all that.
How did you feel?
Angry. Very angry at Japan about that time, because I was a patriotic kid. I was a country boy, but I always wanted to go to the Navy because the neighbor boy had been on in the Navy and from 1928 to 1931, and he was on submarines. And when I was aboard the submarine base over there going to mine school, I met him. He had been called back in the reserves, and I met him. I was walking down the shower one night. He was right ahead of me. I seen his name on the towel. He had a funny name, Neverdusky.
Neverdusky?
Yeah, he was Polish-Russian, his father was. His name was Neverdusky. And he was a nice young fellow, and I found out he was on the USS Dolphin. And I went aboard her, you know, several times. I went over to see him on the board. But that was one reason. He was one reason I was in the Navy. I always wanted to go, and when I asked my dad to sign, he said, "What do you want to go in now for?" I said, "You know, danger of being in war, this and that." I said, "That's why I want to go in now." I said, "I want to go in there, and I don't want to go in there green. I want to know something before I go in, you know, before we do get in war." And I was always interested in history, and I prided myself as well as we could going to North Lima School out there of. At that time, we used to have what we call current events tests.
Yep.
We had a little paper, current events,
mm-hmm.
that we got once a month or something like that. And I really liked this because when I was a kid, up until I was 13 years old, we didn't even have a radio, we didn't have a radio or newspaper or even electric lights. Because at that time, we lived over in the country up there with Detweiler Road, we lived off of 165.
Yep, I know where that is.
And well, we lived right up there on Detweiler Road, and if you go off 165 at the first bend, if you didn't make the bend, you went right in our driveway. We had a little 27-acre truck farm up there, and us kids learned to work, and we worked. There were six of us in the family. We worked hard, because when we were young kids, the Depression was on, and Dad couldn't afford those times to hire anybody. We did hire a neighbor girl to help pick strawberries, but we were expected to go pick strawberries, and you don't eat them. We pick beans, and you pick them clean.
Yep.
And when Dad and Mom went to market, they left you plenty to do.
Oh, yeah.
Although we, like all kids, we cut some of it, you know.
Do me a favor. I want to make sure I've got this. What's your mother's maiden name?
My mother's maiden name was Martin, but she died when I was 4 days old.
4 days old?
She had scarlet fever, and she had a relapse. Died. And then when I was about a year and a half old, my dad married a Mary Whittem. And she was down here from Michigan. She lived up around Cadillac, Michigan.
You remember your mom's first name?
Edna.
Edna Martin.
Edna Martin.
And your stepmother was?
Mary Whittem.
Mary Whittem.
Mm-hmm.
W-H-I-T?
W-H-I-T-T-U-M.
Whittem.
Whittem. Yep. And like I say, we were kept busy as kids. We didn't have no time for it. Well, we didn't have time to, you know, sports. And that's, I couldn't go and take baseball in high school or anything because I had to go home work.
Let me ask you about this. Third day after Pearl Harbor, there you are in the West Virginia. You don't recall exactly what you're doing, some kind of work party. By then...
Yes, it was a working party. I forget what it was for. I don't. Never did really know what it was for, I don't believe.
What did you do? Do you know anything of what
you did? I don't know
that
anything that anybody did, except we went there and we looked around to see what we could see, you know what I mean? But we didn't have any divers to go down below underwater, you know, I don't, that I recall, or anything. I don't know whether we were just going to see what we could salvage. If there was anything we could salvage from topside is what I think we was really on there for.
Were you recovering bodies?
No, we didn't recover any bodies.
Had that all been done?
They'd been pretty well done as far as I know. I didn't see any bodies at all after the, you know, after the initial day of attack.
About 5 or 6 days later, maybe a week later, what were you doing?
Well, it began to get kind of monotonous then again, you know, you realize that they weren't going to, the Japs weren't going to come back, although we did stay, we did keep watches, you know, pretty regular. We had regular watches. But we realized that there had been a sneak attack, we understood that, that they, the ships were gone, they weren't going to be coming back. It kind of went into routine, and then it became kind of boring because we didn't have the shore, the freedom to go ashore like we had before.
You had to stay on board.
It was military law at that time, as I recall it. You know, and they were trying to organize things so they could send parties ashore for rest and recreation, that sort of thing. And still not cause confusion because I think the top of, you know, the top chain of command was still pretty much in transition here. How do we do this? What do we, you know, Admiral Kimmel and Short had been in danger of being relieved of their command.
Which they were shortly thereafter.
Yeah. And the chain of command was kind of...
Confusing?
Confused, disorganized, I would say, probably at that time, you know.
No direct orders. It seemed like things were in disarray.
Yeah, they just kind of let it go, and if somebody would, I suppose... You know, somebody did think, he said, hey, we got to get these guys on, you know, for recreation and that a little bit. They can't just sit out there in ships, or the ones that are on ships and that. The ones that are in bases can't just stay there. They got to have a little chance to go to town. And they started doing these kind of things and getting them organized again and getting shore leave set up and that sort of thing so you could go ashore and everything. But,
you were on general quarters the whole time?
No. But you'd stand watches like you'd stand four out of 12 hours, you'd stand. You'd have like 3 watches set up. You'd stand 4 out of 12.
In other words, 4-hour watch?
Yeah.
And you do 2 watches a day?
Yeah. And they were setting that kind of thing up, and they were moving, the army was consolidating their positions, you know, and everything else, because they did not have, they had what they called out there, they had a flexible line or a elastic line, more or less. At one time had been talked about building something like the Maginot Line, you know. But they had they figured to have their troops so they could move them in a short time to any point on the island they needed to, because they had Diamond Head protecting one side, the mountains on the other side, and they were pretty well pretty well set up so that a good flexible army could do something. And they did. I remember, as I was telling you there earlier, in between attacks, I remember hearing on the radio that they were giving instructions in Honolulu that the army was on the move then through Honolulu. They were going. They were,
in other words, military authority.
Yeah, they were moving already. They had already.
You got your radio news on board?
Yeah, we had radio, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Was there any radio restriction?
No. Not in regular, you know, regular radios. We didn't have short wave or anything like that, you know. But
well, the radio room had that.
Yeah, they would have it, yeah.
So, we're about a week after Pearl. Things are kind of in disarray. You guys know that Admiral Short and General Short, Admiral Kimmel are in trouble. You still don't have anything particular to do, but a lot of sitting and waiting. What's the first action that takes place? When does your ship actually go to work?
Well, we don't. We stayed there. We stayed there until about April or May 1942. We stayed there.
4 months.
At Pearl, yeah. We stayed there because we're not an action ship. Then we went, we sailed, and we went to Tonga Tabu, the island of Tonga, down on the equator.
Did you do any tending duty?
And then we
four months you stayed in the harbor.
As I remember, our metalsmiths, and they put a patch on the Raleigh. If you're taking torpedoes.
Yeah, right.
And they put a patch on Raleigh. They went the underwater dive. They did underwater and everything. They put a patch on. And we also had sent, men from our ship had gone over to work the ship, you know, the ships that were in dry dock and had to needed help on them.
Yeah, because the Japanese bombed the gate for the dry dock.
Yeah, and that sort of stuff. They did, they helped out in all of that that they could, you know what I mean? And we had working parties even for various little things, you know, that needed to be done that wouldn't have been, had to be done had it not been for the attack, you know.
Give me an idea.
Just free working parties. I like to clean up, just to clean up someplace, just clean up debris.
Did you do some of those?
I didn't get on very many of those because, for whatever reason, because I wasn't selected or, you know, just, it was mostly deck force and that sort of thing that was on as working parties. They sent them.
So they kept you on board most of the time.
And it began to get monotonous because I wanted to get on a destroyer. I wanted to get, see, I was young and I didn't know different, and I wanted to get out where the fight was. And it just seemed like here I was on this ship, supposedly for transfer to a destroyer, and here I am sitting. See. And right about that time, outside of guys coming on board and being sent off again, our people were froze, you know.
Okay.
Because I even tried to get on the old tug Vireo.
Really?
I tried to get on a tug. I thought I was going to get on one of these tugs one time.
The Vireo had a busy day in the harbor that day.
But in fact, I thought I was going to, you know, get on one of these things. I thought, well, it wasn't exactly what I wanted, but at least I thought, well, I'd be doing something. You know, you're moving around. You're not just sitting there swinging around a buoy. And that was what I had hoped for. So.
Now, they moved some of the guys from the battleships. Mm-hmm. They shifted them over onto other ships.
Yeah.
When did you get shifted?
I didn't get shifted till we got to Australia in 1943.
So in other words, you took off,
you went down to
Tonga.
We stayed there and swung around the buoy, and we took care of the ships when they come in, but we stayed there. We took care of the ships from like the Coral Sea and all those battles, you know, those kind of battles that were taking place out there. And then we moved on to New Caledonia. I don't know whether it was about 8 months later, something like that. We moved to New Caledonia.
Yeah.
And we anchored out there on a buoy. And we stayed there till 1943. We went to Australia for rest and recreation.
How were you supplied?
Supply ships that came in, you know, big, regular, not troop ships, regular supply ships that brought food and everything in. And working parties, we did it.
Now let me ask you a question. Since you got crack at the supply ships, you think your food ration was a little better?
No.
Or just the same?
No, the main thing was though we always had it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We ate the same thing that like they ate on destroyers. Well, we always had it. Sometimes they'd run short on one thing or another a little bit till they got back in. But we always had it. That was the best thing about it. And it wasn't always the best food, but Navy has lots of it.
Yeah, that Navy always had a reputation for having lots of food.
That's one thing I liked about the Navy. As long as your ship wasn't sunk, you had a place you could sleep. It was dry. You weren't laying in the water in a foxhole somewhere, you know, or something like that. We did get monotonous for them. In fact, I had a rough time. I mean, I had a rough time with my nerves because I was a person that was restless. I didn't take to orientation just what I mean, just sitting there, you know. I want to be doing something, you know. Anything if it's wrong, do something, you know. But we weren't doing anything. And it did bother me. It bothered me, and I had a spell with my nerves because I wasn't resting. It was my own fault.
Were you frustrated?
Yeah, more or less. It was that. It was an anxiety type thing.
Were you angry too?
Yes.
Did you feel? You feel like you wanted revenge?
Oh, against the Japs, yes. Yeah, we wanted to tear them apart. We wanted to go there and sink the island and destroy it.
Most of the other guys were young.
Yeah.
They feel the same way.
Yeah, I think they did. Yeah.
What about the old salts?
Oh, they were worse. They were worse because they had seen some of this. They'd been over in China and all that, you know, and then the Yangtze River and some of this stuff. And they see, we didn't understand these people at all, and they didn't understand us, of course. And it wasn't a case of, there's no nice war. Today we try to have nice wars. You can't have a nice war. Because if I'm shooting at you, that's not nice. You know what I mean? There's no way it's nice. I don't care.
That's right.
And you can say, well, I'll go out here with a gun, but I won't pull it unless he shoots at me. Well, it's too late then, you know. It's too late. You're dead. And we're not playing, you know what I mean? It isn't the case. Too many people, I think, anymore. It's just like young people that go out here and shoot people. They don't realize the finality of it. They don't realize that they know better, but they don't realize the finality of it. They see it in the movies all the time. The guy shot, next time you see him next day in another movie, you know, or something. It isn't the finality. That man, that life is gone. You know, I don't think they realize.
They don't realize the value. You
know. Well, about this time in life, I did realize it. And it started to settle in on me a little bit that what's the use in this world, you know what I mean? No matter where I got in this world, someday I had to die and leave it. And this troubled me, and I didn't have the right kind of counseling. When I had a problem with it that gave me any kind of a physical feeling or spell, you know what I mean? I talked to the doctor, and they didn't, if they would have sat down then and told me what they told me later on, I'm in great shape, because I'm intelligent enough to grasp it. But they didn't. Oh, well, you'll be all right pretty soon. It'll get worse. It'll get. It might get a little worse, but then it'll get better and better, and you'll be all right. See, and they don't tell me anything. Of course, your mind runs away with you. I'm a healthy boy. I've never been sick a day in my life, hardly. Although I did contract. I don't know what you call it. I call it yellow jaundice. I was as yellow as I could be, like this shelf here. And for a month, I had to have the corpsman go with me to eat because I wasn't allowed to eat. I didn't have the rabies fats, you know, anything like that. I was allowed to have. And my grandmother on my father's side had died of yellow jaundice. You know, and of course, to me, that didn't frighten me that much, but it was just some of the things I didn't understand, you know. That,
what year was that?
That would have been 42. That was in 42. During, well, we're still in Pearl Harbor, so it started.
You were under stress then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this went on while I was in the Navy, although it didn't handicap me. In fact, when I was discharged, that's why I was discharged. One reason.
What year was that?
This was 1945. But I asked the man, I says, I knew then, you know, my nerves had given me trouble. I knew it was partly my own fault because I wasn't getting rest. I was drinking and things. And I wasn't getting rest like I should at that time. I realized that I was tearing my own body down by, you know, by not getting the rest I should get, even when I could get rest, when we weren't standing watches and things.
Mm-hmm.
I'd sit around half the time and talk to the guys on watch before I lay down and, you know, maybe catch 2 hours instead of three or four, you know. And I knew this wasn't the way to treat your body, but
What drove you? What drove you?
I don't know. I don't really know. To be honest with you, I don't know.
Were you apprehensive?
A little bit, I couldn't tell about what. You know, I had an unreasoning, I wouldn't call it fear, but an anxiety. Coupled with this idea that there's no use, you know, there's no use, no matter where I go.
That it was pointless.
Yeah, it was pointless. That's the best way to put it. And I couldn't shake it. There'd be times I'd shake it for a while, but it was just like a dark cloud over you all the time, you know. It seemed at this age and everything, you know. And eventually I did get shake it, you know. I mean, I shook it for you. But if the doctors would have just told me first, you got a problem with your nerves, you know, get all the rest you can and then all right. But they didn't tell me that, you know. They knew what was the matter. They knew it was the nerves. And eventually they didn't call it battle fatigue, they called it operational fatigue. And I laughed. I said, that's the first time I ever heard of getting it out of bottle. That's what I told him. So I was always a clown. But seriously, And I did, when they asked me, they said, do you want to discharge now? This was when I was discharged. I said, no. I said, I only got a year, I think a year and 4 months to do or something. I said, I can do that standing on my head. I don't worry about that. I said, I just want to feel like I did when I came into this outfit. I said, well, we got to send you to the hospital. I don't want to go to the hospital. Well, you got to go. Or we can't do anything with it, you know.
They send you in?
So eventually I went. But when I got in the hospital...
And this is 42?
Yeah, this is 45.
Oh, okay, 45, the end of the war.
Yeah, this man, I get in the hospital out there. I'd have been gone and back in Pacific again, except I didn't get my gear. My gear was held up. When I mustered out there, I was sent from... I was supposed to have shore duty... Not by choice, but I was supposed to have shore duty on Dam Neck, Virginia as a gunnery instructor. And we just got settled there, and here come a draft in him, 105 third class and 15 second class, and I was second class gunner there. And I knew right away, I was about the first one drawn out of the hat. See, none of us second class had volunteered. So they put our names in the hat and drew them out. He's the first or second one drawn out. So here I'm on my way to the West Coast to go into sea again. But I never got my gear. I never got to after I got out of the Navy for a year. It was out in Point Pleasant, California. It's somewhere up in the mountains.
There's a storage facility there. That's what there is. Well, there still is.
It took them over a year to get it for me, even then. I mean,
no
kidding. I was out of the Navy over a year before I ever got my baggage.
Mercy.
But that's why I didn't go to sea. I fell out on the grinder for mustard. And he said, where's your baggage? I said, it hasn't got here. Fall out. And so I was a master at arms out there in the black barracks, putting the master at arms out there. Till I got sent to Corpus Christi because they were moving out. The Okinawa casualties were starting to come back. And they wanted to make room. And so no more shore duty, you either stay or you go home. You either go to sea or you go home. And I would have turned it down because I could pass a physical and everything. But I goofed up one night. I went ashore, got drunk, fell asleep. And I was supposed to be back at midnight. I could go ashore every night. And somebody, they woke me up and said, what time, Dad? I said, in the morning. And I come back in the morning, nobody ever said a word to me. You just automatically don't get a pass anymore, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I might as well go with the draft. So they had me this draft, and I was telling this nurse about it. She said, what do you care? You're going home anyhow. And I thought you were just kidding, you know. And that's about what happened. I just let them do it, you know, let them send me home. Because when I got out there, I saw, they called me up about 2 days or three after I got out there to Corpus Christi, talked to a doctor. 3 or 4 days later, they called me up before a medical board and recommended me for discharge. I didn't argue about it, you know. Especially if I know what I knew after, I might have, but... Because I should have stayed in, really. I should have stayed in the Navy. It's been 30 years. It wouldn't hurt me a bit.
Now, you got transferred in 43.
Yeah, off the USS Whitney. I got transferred in Sydney, Australia.
Where'd you go?
For new construction. Come back to the States and... Went to the West Coast up to Bremerton, put a ship in commission, USS Satterley, the destroyer. USS Satterley, S-A-T-T-E-R-L-E-E. Satterley.
Oh, Satterley.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was not a big new fast one. It was still the old 1500 class destroyer. It had 4 gun mounts on it, torpedo tubes and depth charge and that. But it wasn't one of the big fast ones, the 2200 class and that we had.
What was your job?
Gunner's mate. I was still
still gunner's mate.
Second class gunner's mate. I was a mount captain during attack. I was a mount captain.
Describe that job.
Number one gun. You had to have. You wore the headphones and everything in case the director went out for any reason. You took over and directed your crew, and you had to even do the spotting for them. I was a qualified gun pointer and spotter.
You'd taken that training for that.
Yeah,
we were talking about that earlier, plane spotting.
In other words, you're firing a target, and you see you're firing low, you tell them up 300 or whatever, bring it up to them.
Was that
you had to do that. But normally, we just sat there because we were under control of the director. Even your guns moved by the director. So,
Was your, is it hard to spot planes?
Yeah, pretty hard, because they were getting pretty fast then, you know, even for us, even your old, your bought Corsair that the Navy had was a pretty fast plane at that time. You shoot those things, you'd climb like a Grumman dive, you know. They had the power to climb, and they weren't easy to spot, you know, coming in, especially in a little cloud, with clouds here and there.
So you leave Washington State, new ship.
Yep, we shipped down off the West Coast.
Green crew?
Pretty much, except us guys that had come from other ships. Naturally, you had your skeleton crew, it was all veteran, you know, from another ship.
Right, yep.
But then we shipped down off the West Coast, and we took the British aircraft carrier.
Which
Victoria.
One? Victoria?
Victoria, through the canal. Two destroyers, we brought her through the canal, the Harding and the Saturday, brought her through the canal. And then went on the East Coast. We still finished some of our shaking down off the East Coast. We went to Portland, we went to Boston, we escorted President Truman to the Army-Navy football game, his yacht.
Vice President.
President.
Well, he was president by then.
Yeah, he was president by then. Well, this is
late now. No, Truman doesn't become president until 45.
45, let's see.
44,
45? It was 44. No, that would have been 44. 44, it wasn't bad.
You're right, 44.
It would have been Roosevelt, wouldn't it, in 44.
Roosevelt in 44, that's right. Truman dies in April, or Roosevelt
Truman
dies
died
in April of 45.
45, see, so it must have been Roosevelt. I always keep thinking Truman, but it must have been Roosevelt that went to the football game on the yacht.
Yeah, that's right. Okay,
it would have been
Roosevelt.
I was discharged in July 45, and I'd been in April, I was out at Oakland, California.
You are along the East Coast shaking down some more.
Yeah, we're shaking down some more, and then they started running Casablanca, and they sent me to advanced gunnery school, see, because the gunnery school I went to did not have the latest electrohydraulic. I hadn't had that, see.
Which gun is that?
So they sent the 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft surface gun.
Okay.
And I had not had this system at all, so they sent me to Norfolk, Virginia, to that school.
How did it work?
What do you mean?
Describe it. How did that system work? That's
an electrohydraulic system.
Yeah.
It was driven with hydraulics, which is oil, compressed oil.
Right.
You use an electric motor to drive the pump. The signal is sent from the director key or from the gun key right here on the gun. What we did when we would mount the gun crew would mount the gun, you would give them the command match pointers and switch to automatic. And that's what they would do. They'd bring the wheel around till the pointer lined up with another pointer inside there that was being moved by the director. And you'd match them or even come that close to them. You just switch the thing into automatic there and sit back and ride. And the director was doing everything with your guns.
And the gun would do everything after that?
It would move where the director told it to move, you know. In other words, the directors would get in on the planes or anything, and the guns would move right with it.
Was it accurate?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were accurate. They were accurate. We landed the Rangers on Pointe de Hoe over Normandy. We did that. I got back up. After school, I got back on, and we made the Normandy invasion. And we made the Southern France invasion. Then I come back again.
You made the Normandy invasion as well?
Southern France invasion.
Describe that.
Normandy, we landed the Rangers on Pointe de Hoe. We were by ourselves, kind of, up the beach. And they landed these Rangers. These various Rangers were assigned to different ships that they were using for artillery, see. They used us as an artillery piece, you know. And we landed these Rangers over this 110-foot cliff. They used grapnel hooks. And they went up these lines. Well, the Germans ran along the top. They started trying to cut the lines and dropping hand grenades down. So we opened fire, and we were in close enough. We opened fire on 40 millimeters.
Now,
we strafed them with 40 millimeters up there on the cliff, the Germans.
Let's back up just a little.
Mm-hmm.
When did you know this was the invasion of Europe?
Of Europe?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, about a month before it happened. We knew we were getting ready for it. We were in Portland, England. And you could see the build-up of ship was horrific. I mean, something like we hadn't even dreamed before, you know. And we were out in the channel running, practicing. The Houston came over and they held a mock invasion about, 4 or 5 weeks before we held a mock invasion on Dover. We went through it. It was a mock invasion. It was the USS Houston heavy cruiser. In fact, we knew we were going to be in it. And then the night we were supposed to leave, they called it off one day because of the rough, the channel was so rough. And we thought, well, it has to be scrubbed, but then the next day we went. It was go day. And that was something to behold, I tell you.
So you're near Point de Hoe.
Yeah.
You were close to shore.
Yeah, 1,500 feet.
Who was it that ran right up almost virtually on a ground firing? There was another ship that did this.
I don't know that, but we were then 1,500. They were firing at us with an anti-tank gun.
They were shooting an anti-tank gun at you.
At us. That's how close we were in there.
You were close.
They straddled us with it until our gunnery officer Otter commenced rapid firing. And I was on number one gun. We fired for a minute. And when we were done, we counted the, over your powder can, you have a little cap that you pull off of the lanyard.
Right.
Pull it in the corner. We counted 21 of those. 21 rounds in a minute.
In a minute.
5 inch 38.
That's a lot of fire.
We just obliterated that top of that hill.
Were the shore batteries firing? Were there any shore batteries there?
Well, that's all that fired at us anymore. Of course, they had bombed that place the night before all night long. It was a steady thunder of bombs all night long. We could hear, we were out in the middle of the channel, it was shaking the ship out there in the middle. Loaded planes are going this way and empties coming back over here. Just like a two-way street, you know, like a throughway.
You could see the Germans cutting the lines.
You'd see them running along the top. You couldn't tell exactly what they were trying to cut the lines and drop hand grenades. What they're trying to do is loosen the lines, drop hand grenades down to kill the Rangers that are coming up.
And you guys just laid it on them.
And we strafed them with the 40 millimeters first. See, 40 millimeters, we had twin 40s.
Yeah.
Two barrels.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah. I know the one you're talking of.
We were strafing with the 40 millimeters. And then we brought two guns to bear. Of course, we didn't come broadside. We were going to bring four guns on because that would give them a bigger target. We were pointed
bow
at
on.
Them. We were pointed at them, and they straddled us, one on one side, one on the other. And that's when the number one and two gun, I was on number one. We opened fire for a minute, rapid fire.
21 rounds in a minute. That's a lot. What was your job in that?
Mount Captain, I was sitting up on a little platform in the back, and there's an opening in the top of the gun mount.
Right.
And I could stick my head out there and see what was going on, although at that time I wasn't. I was watching what was going on in the gun because it wasn't that safe to have your head out at that range either.
But were you in command, or did they just fire at will?
No more. I was in command till late. When they went into rapid fire, they just kept loading.
Let them go.
That's all. See, that 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft surface gun is one of the greatest guns ever built. Nobody's come close to it. We had an up and down hoist just like this. And they just kept putting the shells in down below them. And you take one out, it automatically brings the other one up. I mean, not slowly, it goes zzzz, and she's there. and the powderman grabs the powder out of the thing in the floor. He throws the powder in, the man throws the shell, and he hits the ram and reaches for another shell. The gun goes closed, boom, and comes open again, and he throws another in.
That's fast.
Just in the reach of the rammers, a lever like this.
How many people in the crew? How many people in the crew?
The powderman, the shellman, and a hot shellman is supposed to knock the shells down. When they come out, he's got asbestos gloves. Because when that casing comes out, it's about this long. It's hot.
They're hot.
And there's a hole in the back of the turret. And they don't want him rolling around in there. If you can keep from him, you try to knock him out.
Throw him out the hole?
Where you go out, steer him out that hole if you can.
You get to sit back.
You got the mount captain, the pointer, the trainer, because they have to stay there mounted. You even have a fuse setter.
Yep.
So that's four. Then you have the two loaders.
That's six?
And seven men.
Seven guys, including the mount captain.
Yeah. Including the mount captain. Five
shellman, a loader,
powderman,
fuse setter,
a pointer, and a trainer,
a pointer,
and
a trainer,
and a mount captain.
And a mount captain, that's seven. You.
Yep.
That's seven men.
Two gun crew, yeah.
Work as a team, 21 rounds in 1 minute.
21 rounds in a minute.
That's around every 3 seconds.
That's really firing. The British had run, they had a new cruiser over there, and they thought it was really good. They put, I think they said they could fire something like 12 rounds a minute or something like that. They thought that was really good.
tell me more about Point de Hope.
Well, we landed the Rangers on Point de Hope, and then we just laid back, and they used us for artillery. See, this guy, one was assigned us, his code name was Rocky, and he's got a walkie-talkie, and we got the TBS or ship radio, you know.
Right.
You can hear him talking, you can hear him on it, you know, and he would start us out, we'd commence firing, and he would take out he'd follow a road, like, you know, up 50, up 50, up 50, then you go around a bend, left 50, or whatever, and then you knock out a bridge and that's it, cease fire, you know, until he found another target.
Which Ranger group was this?
Well, I don't know which one it was or anything. It was just called a group of Rangers. Now, I don't know, you know, what outfit it came out of or anything, but these men were special trained for that. And at one time he says, whoop, so I'll be back after a while, it's getting too hot here now. And then he was gone a while, and pretty soon he came back on. Hello, Stardust, this is Rocky. You know, and he's back
on.
So
they called you Stardust?
Yeah, her code name was Stardust.
Stardust.
And it was quite... And we fired all the ammunition we had, but about 15 rounds. We went back across the channel that night with 15 rounds of ammunition and reloaded.
You filed everything?
Reloaded in England and came back over. Next morning we were back on station.
Now how many rounds is that, do you know?
About 1,500, something like that, we fired.
That's for one gun?
No, that's
for everybody?
For the four guns. We carried about 1,500 rounds.
And you went home with 15 rounds?
15 rounds. We had to go back across the channel in case we surfaced the sub or something. Had to use it. But we of course, it's not 460 miles across there, you know, so it didn't take that long to do it. You get a destroyer, kick her up to about 30 knots or something, and you get across there pretty fast.
How much of the entire invasion force did you see?
We didn't see a lot of it. We were near the Nevada. The Nevada had been damaged and everything in Pearl. She's come back to States and was refitted. She came out like a new ship. She had the old two tower was gone. She was swept like a cruiser, you know.
Right.
And she had 14-inch gun. She was laying out there. She was shelling. And then the Houston, we saw her. And, you know, a lot of small boats we could see, but we couldn't see what was going on in Omaha Beach or anything like that. Because then they moved us to the outer screen, see. Mm-hmm. After we landed the Rangers, that job was done. They moved us to the outer screen, and we screened all those ships. We were patrolling out there. So that U-boats and pew boats or anything else couldn't come in and get after the attack the supply ships.
Was there much of a difference between, did you see any German planes?
No, I didn't even see a German plane on that day. I didn't see one.
Did you ever encounter
any? It was amazing. Only when we were in Plymouth, England, one or two came over one night. They didn't drop any bomb near us. I heard the explosion, but they didn't drop them near the Portlandville Harbor where we were at.
That was the only time?
It was the only time I saw any German planes at all.
Never got
it. Didn't even see them. I heard
guns never got trained on them.
No. Didn't see them. They didn't want us to open fire for fear of giving away position in on the harbor.
Yeah.
They didn't want them to know there was anything in the harbor. So they just wanted them to think it was empty. Because they were massing ships there, and they were all blacked out. You know, but they were massing ships there, for the attack.
How much secrecy was there a couple days before the invasion?
No, a lot. There was a lot.
Were you allowed off ship?
No. And they didn't allow us. They had Hitler fooled. See, they had him really fooled because he wouldn't listen. If he'd listened to some of his generals, he'd have been prepared for that because they told him to watch the area, you know.
Rommel knew.
But yeah, they feinted and made it look like they were going to land and did somewhere else.
Yeah, they were looking for Pas-de-Calais, yeah, and the Germans were set up for
they were
it.
All set for that.
But Rommel knew that.
Yeah, I heard later that he did. You know,
the Sherbrooke Peninsula was Sherbrooke. Certainly a...
He told them that that's the ideal place to land. That's what he told them. Mm-hmm. Listen to him. So Hitler listened to somebody else. That's how wars are won.
Yeah.
Somebody pulled the boo-boo.
So we get through 1944. What happens After June 6th, what goes on?
Then we patrolled for a while. I remember like 2 or 3 weeks, and then we went to southern France, Mediterranean, Normandy invasion.
What'd you do down there?
We were down there. I think it was in August when they made the invasion. We probably went down there in the latter part of July. And we were down there patrolling around for a couple of weeks, and then they gathered up the force. We met the force, and they made the southern France invasion. We mostly did screening there. We didn't do. We sunk a Q-boat that was trying to break the screen one night. The Harding and the Saturday were out on patrol there, and we sunk a Q-boat coming in. We took German prisoners then.
What was that like?
A lot of firing, a lot of confusion, a lot of noise, you know what I mean, until we just rapid fire until we finally said, cease firing. Somebody said, we got him.
What was the attitude of the Germans? You see them?
Defiant, more or less. They were sorry looking a lot, most of them, and they were kids and old men mostly. The commander of that boat was a fairly young fellow, but he was wounded pretty badly. And he didn't want any blood transfusion.
He didn't want any American blood.
He didn't want any blood mixed with his Aryan blood. He didn't want it.
He was a hardcore Nazi.
Yeah, he was a hardcore Nazi, that guy was.
Now let me ask you a question.
A Q-boat's not as big as a PT boat, but it's
they're a little bigger than
like a PT.
They're a
boat,
step
yeah.
up. An yeah. E-boat's like a PT boat,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And a Q-boat's a bit bigger,
no,
more like
Well, this wasn't what they called. These old Italian Q-boats is what they were. The Germans were manning, and they were just maybe just a step under a PT boat. They probably had 2 torpedoes instead of 4. So a PT boat carried 4 torpedoes on.
Okay,
like
so
Kennedy was on, you know.
Right, so a Q-boat...
They probably carried a couple and some...
Q-boat's about the same size as a PT.
Yeah.
And an E-boat was roughly the same.
Yeah.
Or maybe a touch bigger, if I remember right.
A Q-boat, originally in the First World War, a Q-boat was a big ship, usually. Fast and heavy gun, you know.
Yep.
That's what they call Q-boats. But anyhow, I came back to the States. We came back and I had a choice. I could either make my... See, I'd been busted from first-class gunner. I made first-class gunner and been busted in Pier 92 in New York, which the captain really had no authority to bust me. The charge was accurate, but I had no chance to defend myself. And what had happened, I had borrowed a pea coat. He traded a guy a blanket in Norfolk for a pea coat when I left school. I'd been through the first gunnery school. I traded him because I was going up north. I knew I needed a pea coat, and somebody stole mine. He needed a blanket, so I traded him this blanket for a pea coat. Well, ordinarily, you're supposed to take that clothing or that blanket to the master at arms and have him mark DC in it. Well, people didn't bother doing it, you know. Just a negligent thing, and I get up in Pier 92 in New York, and there's Stephen Close about. I was going out to take my uniform across the street and have it pressed. They want to check the names in the pea coat like this when you come up, you know. Wearing clothing with another man's stencil, you can't defend against that. You know what I mean? Now, if they'd have given me a summary court or something, then I could have. They tried to put me out of the Navy, you know, after stealing. But they didn't. They didn't charge me with stealing, just wearing clothes with another man's stencil. I was guilty of that.
Yeah.
Through negligence, he put me in a brig, busted me back to second class. And he really didn't have that authority because he didn't give me the rank, you know. He didn't have but this old man was getting away with a lot up there in the pier. His wife was as powerful as he was, and he was getting away with a lot of stuff.
Who was it?
I don't even remember his name. Never did. Oh, I had heard it, yeah, because I knew him and her both, their name, but I wasn't on there long, you know what I mean? But they put me on an old USS Camden, which was had been captured in the First World War from the Germans.
Mm.
She was the brig, and it was cold in there. Slept on the springs, that was all you had. You didn't have no rights then. You didn't hear anything about prisoners' rights, you know. Prisoner in our own brig, you know. You did whatever they give you, and you did what they told you. That was it. But anyhow, I had the chance to get my rank. They said, if you stay on Saturday, you get your rate back. And they told me they were going to make a mine sweep, a high-speed sweep out of it, and send her to the South Pacific. Or I could get my rank back if I stayed on the ship, or I could go to gunnery school in Washington, D.C. And I said, you know, I'm gone. I'm out of here. So I turned down the rank and went to Washington, D.C. And when I was coming out of there, that's when I was shipped to the West. Was supposed to go for new construction after I went through that school.
Yeah.
Then I went to California instead and lost my baggage, and that's how I wound up.
And that's how you came out?
Yeah, that's how I got discharged out of California and everything, out of Corpus Christi.
When you came home, how'd you feel?
Great. I was glad to get out. After, in retrospect, after things are over, I should have stayed in, because I had a buddy that joined with me. He stayed in 20 years and was a radioman. And he liked the Navy fine, although it never did him any good, because the last I heard from him, he's a beachcomber on Pearl City over there.
Really?
Yeah, he got divorced, couldn't live with a wife, and, you know, married a wife with children, couldn't live with her, and got divorced and went back to Pearl Harbor. The last time some friends of mine went to see him over there, they went over there, and they went to see him and picked him up, and they said he was just a beachcomber.
Did you go over on the 50th? Anniversary?
No, I didn't get to go.
When's the last time you were Pearl?
1942 when I left there. I never got back. Never got back there. Everybody told me, even in 1944, they said you wouldn't even know the place anymore. And I would have liked to have gone, and after it was all over, my daughter up here in Warren said to me, she says, well, how come you didn't know? If I'd have known that, she said, I'd have seen that you got to go. I said, now you tell me.
You know, you want
to
go?
We didn't have the finances to do it. My wife and I didn't have, and I didn't want to go without her anyhow.
Do you want
to
go?
Yeah, I would like to go. Yeah, I would really like to go. I would like to go on then, you know, when Bill and, or when Bishop and all of them,
yeah,
and Bob,
yeah,
and them went out, and Chuck and all of them, I'd like to go out there. Yeah, I'd kind of like to go out to Pearl Harbor and to Hawaii and see, but I don't know that I ever will, probably won't, but it's nice. It'd be nice to be.
I got one last thing for you.
Yeah.
When it's all said and done, how do you feel about the Japanese now?
I don't have any problem with the present Japanese. They're just like our kids now, like my kids. They don't know anything about the war. You know what I mean? They weren't in power then. They had nothing to do with it. And we've always had wars. We're always going to have wars. I don't know where we get the idea that we're going to stop wars, when, like forming the United Nations.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm a Christian man, and I read my Bible, and I read it daily. The Bible tells me there's going to be wars and rumors of wars, and so far that Bible hasn't missed a thing, regardless of, you know, I mean, I'm not peddling anything, but regardless of what we want to say, whether we believe it, whether we don't, it's not missed any predictions yet. And we're seeing fulfilled every day. I'm very serious. Children being, what would you say, suing their parents, things like that, you know. It says, it tells that in there, way back, in Timothy it tells about it. Disobedient to parents, truce breakers, all that kind of thing. And here we've made a big mistake, and that's the only political thing I'll say. We made a terrible mistake when we did the Korean thing, when we did the Vietnam thing. It was a terrible mistake, because you cannot fight a nice war. If you're going into fight, you're going to get in the ring and fight me, you can't tie your hands behind your back and conduct, say, now, Earl, don't hit me, don't, you know, you can't do
I
that.
You,
it don't
you.
Work. These people don't live that way, you know.
Let me ask you one question then related to that. How did you feel about the Persian Gulf?
I was glad they made a move, only if only to redeem ourselves from Vietnam, mostly, I think.
Was it valuable for them?
I think so, for that, in that thing in itself. I think the United States needed that, really. You know, I mean, just like a morale builder, a we're back again, you know, because we've had so much criticism of our nation by people that live here and get the benefits of it. I can't understand it. But I do understand it in a way. They don't know any. If they lived during the Depression, then they'd have something they could compare, see. We've had a beautiful country. I've been all over it. I drove a truck. I've been in every state in the 48 with a truck. It's a great, big, beautiful country. And sure, it's got faults. It's bound to have, you know. But my goodness, to hear some of the, I'm just listening to the news from Washington every day. And the various activist groups. This is a terrible place. And to me, the saddest thing is this. We still have too many people in this country, we don't even need to mention groups, but too many people in this country that think communism or socialism is the way to go. It just hasn't been done right, and that is the biggest fallacy. That's the biggest lie that's ever been perpetrated. It isn't all right. It won't work because people aren't honest. It would work and could work if everybody went by the Bible, do unto others, you'd have others do unto you. You know, that old golden rule?
Oh, yes.
It could work and could work beautifully, but it never will. It just won't because we don't have that kind of people. And you can take a nice, you've seen yourself in life, you can take a nice man here, give him power, give him money, he's a stinker, you know?
Right.
And that's what happened, it's people, because it's here, it's right here in the heart. Until we have a heart change, we're not going to ever see it. It's not going to, I got other news for you, and I'm not going to be in this world all that long anymore, but it ain't going to get better. Regardless of what you're taught, regardless of what you think, it's not going to get better, it's going to get worse. It would get worse. You're seeing the tip of the iceberg in anarchy. I saw a lady last Friday. I go to Rogers every Friday to say. Saw a lady down there, a grown woman, I suppose got kids in school. She has a big t-shirt, question authority. And that's our watchword now, question every authority. You know where that leads? Anarchy. It leads to anarchy. You can't have 250 million voices. You got to have one voice leading. You know, one group or one representative voice leading, you can't please everybody out here on the side street. And that's why this government worked before, but why it's not going to work if we don't make some kind of change. I'm afraid you only, I don't want to say that. I don't want to say that on tape.
You don't have to.
No, the only change we're going to see is what we have in our pocket. That's it this time. I'm afraid.
Thanks, Earl.